And now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Hauck.
Well, hello, hello, everybody. Good afternoon. Friday afternoon here, wherever I'm at, and wherever you are in the world at this time. I just want to welcome you to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. Very excited to be with you here today, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. And if you are new to the program, just reach out and say welcome aboard. You know, always excited to have new listeners, and I'll invite you to be part of the show. You can call in and share your thoughts and so forth a little bit later on here coming up. But I just wanted to say that if you're new to the program, that each and every week, these broadcasts, I always like to focus them on this integration of spirituality and our mental health. And I place our spirituality and mental health integration all within the context of relationships, because that is first and foremost a very key context in our lives, because we are social creatures, you know, and we are in relationship with ourselves, our others, and God, or the divine. And the reason why I place this integration in relationships is that I have been seeing more and more and more over the past several years that people in general, humanity in general, we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds when we are in relationships with one another. Now, that doesn't mean that, okay, I've been wounded, so therefore I'm out of here and I just want to go live in seclusion. That doesn't really work, because those wounds stay with us. Because here's the irony of being in relationship with one another. Not only do we receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual wounds in relationships, but yet we can also discover our greatest healing and strength and peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. And these relationships just might be within our own families, you know, and just how we get along or we don't get along with family members, or how we get along or don't get along with coworkers, or how we get along or don't get along with our friends. Because when you think about it, whenever we transform, whenever we work through our woundedness, we also transform others, you know, and allow them to work through their woundedness. And we transform others through our presence, our grace, and understanding. You know, but first, forgiveness, kindness, compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. And think about it this way. When we are compassionate with ourselves, we can then be compassionate with others, and vice versa. And when we are forgiving with ourselves, then we can be more forgiving with others, and vice versa. And when we are able to live in gratitude with ourselves, just resting in just the awesome gratitude for everything that we have received, everything that we have gone through, everything that has brought us to this moment in our lives, we then discover how this gratitude opens our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others. So in other words, transformation, first and foremost, begins with us. I always love a quote by Henry Nouwen, one of my favorite Christian authors. He says, just by paying attention to what's going on around us, you know, just by tuning in, just being aware, we discover that there are people who heal each other's wounds. There are people who forgive each other's offenses. There are people who share their possessions and foster the spirit of community and celebrate the gifts they have received and live in constant anticipation of the full manifestation of God's glory. So you see, we really cannot take this integration of spirituality and mental health out of the context of relationships, because like I said a little while ago, we are social creatures. And even though it's in relationships where we can become wounded, but we can heal from that woundedness in and through healthier relationships. Well, as I said, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me, or if you want to leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website. It is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you're not able to spend the whole hour with me today, I just invite you to go back in the archives. You can listen to these broadcasts because now they are podcasted. So you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. And as I said, if you would like to call in today and be part of today's show, I invite you to do so. Just call the toll-free line, 888-627-6008. 888-627-6008, and give me your insights, your comments, your thoughts on today's subject, the posture of God. You know, does God have a posture? What kind of posture does God have? Is it just limited to body language, or is there a distinct posture of God? And is it something that we need to adopt, that we take on the posture of God as God gives us an example and so forth? Okay. Well, again, as for those who might be new to the program, I just wanted to go on a little bit further and just explain that I'm a firm believer that all of us come into the world already equipped and graced with everything that we need in this life in terms of our skills, our talents, our giftedness, our strengths and character traits and so forth. And yet, as we go along in life and due to some unpleasant experiences, or maybe we find ourselves in the wrong place at the wrong time, we may feel like we need to hide our giftedness because we don't want to be hurt anymore. We just cannot risk being our authentic selves because it was exploited. Okay. Or we push that giftedness way down inside so that others cannot see it. Or perhaps, let's say we are younger, we are told that we would never amount to anything. Okay, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's nothing special to us. But as we get older and we realize that, you know, like, first of all, that's a lie. Okay, there is something very special to us, and not just one thing, but we are special indeed. And the unfortunate thing is whenever we take in those messages, you know, they're often shame-based, and that eventually, because we don't know how to handle it, or we don't know how to work through these shame comments, we often end up internalizing that shame, and it then has a way of becoming an identity for us, just how we see ourselves through some distorted lens. And we don't often realize our giftedness, and we often go through life functioning from a place of woundedness, or being a victim, instead of a place of healing and wholeness, and embracing our hachetos, our uniqueness. Okay? So, well, let's begin today with, as I always do, a simple question, and then we will get into it here. First of all, how many of you out there in internet radio land gesture with your hands when you speak? Okay? Or let's say it this way. How many of you talk with your hands? Okay? I'm sure we all do, you know, or most of us do, okay? And this could be anything from, you know, that we point with our fingers, or we wave our hands, or as we talk, it seems as though our hands have a language of their own. And actually, they do. You know, in fact, this is the beauty of the American Sign Language for people who are hearing impaired. Have you ever noticed, you know, do your hands just, you know, sit calmly on your lap, or are they just flapping around in all kinds of directions, pointing here and there, making illustrations and emphasizing your words through hand gestures. And so it's true, we often use both our hands and our words, even when we speak to one another, even close friends, or depending, you know, on how strong the emotion is behind our words or, you know, our feelings, we're going to use our hands and so forth. Okay. Well, studies have shown that in the process of communication, this nonverbal expression has about anywhere from 65 to 93% more influence than actual words. You know, and I think this means that, you know, how we say something is often more important than, let's say, what we say. Okay. Well, it is a well-known fact that many people, you know, they're from Italy or Brazil or France or even the United States and England, use their hands during conversations. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, all my ancestors on my father's side came from Germany. But, you know, you know, I use my hands all the time whenever I speak. My hands are flapping around there. I'm pointing and I'm gesturing and I'm using them for emphasis or an illustration or something. Okay. And it's just something that I had just developed. I wasn't taught that. I didn't watch other people. It was just something I started to do. And it was just very comfortable, and I just kept it up. So whenever I'm up in front of people and I'm talking, my arms and my hands are they're not at my side. They're flapping around. Okay. It's just how I speak. Okay. And so when we speak, our mouth is not the only body part that we can use to get the message across. You know, it's true that everybody knows that words are only means of communication. I mean, we have hand gestures, we have facial expressions, we have body movements, we have posture, or we have a certain inflection in our voice that all convey a message or add something to a message. Okay. Well, think about it this way. Here's another way to look at it. How many of us, whenever we hear something interesting from another person, or they're sharing, you know, with us one-on-one or in a crowd, do we do this? Do we typically cut them off and just, you know, say, yes, 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 indeed, indeed. Yeah, go ahead. Keep going. And we don't really do that. You know, but instead, our body language, you know, is emphasized here, where we often lean in closer to let them know that we're interested in what they are saying. You know, we might cock our head to one side or turn our ear so that we could hear better if their voice happens to be faint. And we may even nod our heads in agreement, you know, and just go, mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. You know, this is all nonverbal communication, okay? In fact, and this is something that you can put into practice, I guarantee you this will happen, because we are living in the days of COVID and we are wearing our masks and so forth. And of course, you know, this is very difficult for people who need to read lips, you know, as part of their being hearing impaired. And so, you know, what does a person do if they cannot hear, but they, you know, also cannot see, you know, a mouth move? Okay. But if you really want to know if somebody is listening to you, okay, watch their eyebrows. Okay. Just take a look at their eyebrows. I mean, and don't go up and like stare at them like 6 inches away and, you know, but just make a soft mental note, as it were, to just watch the eyebrows, how they go up and down or how they curl, you know, together or, you know, just eyebrows will convey emotions quicker than anything else. Okay, they're the most expressive facial expression we have, apart from a smile. Okay, so I mean, just be mindful of that. Just watch, you know, and you know, don't be so concerned that you're just like, oh, I'm sorry, I was watching your eyebrows. What did you say? Okay, but just take notice. Okay, you'll be surprised just how eyebrows go up and down. And again, as I said, this is kind of like a dead giveaway as to whether or not somebody is really listening to us. Okay. Well, still, we use all various forms of body language in communication every single day, which is then interpreted by others. You know, think about it this way also. You know, how many of you, you know, are teachers out there? And if you're teaching online, you know, if a student is slouching in his or her chair in class or virtual class, or if they're, you know, making indirect eye contact, but not always. I mean, of course, this is going to signal to you that they're probably bored. Okay. Or if we have ever given directions to somebody, you know, we'll typically point in the direction where that person should go or where to locate something in a store. So these nonverbal gestures or body language, you know, are important clues in letting us know what people are thinking or feeling or desiring, intending, or even dreading. You know, they also help us to communicate more effectively, excuse me, or be more empathetic, even without saying anything. Because all we have to do is just look at a person's eyes, and we can tell, you know, not just that they're listening to us, but we can tell the empathy that's behind the eyes. You know, we can tell the eyes will soften or the body language is, you know, we'll get closer to the person, you know, and so forth. Well, back in 2008, Joe Navarro was a 25-year veteran at that time of the FBI, and he served on the National Security Division's Behavioral Analysis Program, and he was, you know, basically an expert in reading people's body language when it came to interrogations or other moments when he would be the first responder, you know, and then he would just be able to see the stress, not only for perpetrators, but also people who were victims of such crimes. And he would always make note of just what the body language was conveying. And he became very good at this. And he had written an article back in 2008, and he just lists a few just key body languages that communicate so much more than the actual words. So here's a few, okay? Rocking back and forth. I mean, how many of us have ever done this? You know, this is this kind of repetitive behavior, which is soothing or a way to pacify ourselves whenever we're dealing with stress. Okay. You know, and a person's just usually sitting and they just start rocking back and forth, you know, or other, you know, times people just may bounce their foot or, you know, they might strum or drum with their fingers or twirl strands of hair. That, yeah, just passing the time, or maybe it's that nervous energy or to maybe to enjoy a moment or perhaps even to deal with just, you know, just momentary stress or anxiety. So, but getting back to, you know, rocking back and forth, he describes it as a metronome. You know, that little device that's put on pianos and just goes to help keep, you know, the person playing the piano on time, okay, and just gives them a simple beat. And he says, you know, when we start to rock back and forth out of distress or anxiety, you know, it's kind of functioning as a metronome, you know, and we usually, you know, reserve rocking back and forth for extremely stressful situations. You know, when we've received terrible news, or if even we were a key witness to something such as a horrible event, you know, we just feel so overwhelmed and we just start, you know, very gently rocking back and forth with perhaps our arms folded in front of us. And if you think about it, you know, this is also very soothing for babies, you know, because what baby doesn't like to be rocked back and forth and just soothed, and they usually fall asleep and they're very content in, you know, their mother's arms or another caregiver's arms. And it's just interesting, you know, just a person seems to kind of zone out and they're just kind of oblivious to anything else going on around them, you know, as they're just gently rocking back and forth, you know, almost as if to say that this is very soothing. You know, I can just keep doing this maybe for several minutes and so forth. you know. But once you start, you know, it's hard to stop. Okay. Well, years ago, I counseled a 14-year-old girl who was just filled with teenage depression. Okay. She just had, you know, it was clearly depression because she just had the teenage angst to her. She had this attitude, but yet she was deeply, deeply, deeply sad. Okay. And so, wonderfully, she was a talker. So we got on some great subjects and just helping her, like, how do you get out of this, kid, you know, and so forth. Well, one day we got on the subject of, you know, love. And she told me very matter-of-factly that I don't. Okay, you don't what? I don't love. All right, I'll bite. Why? And she said, because when you love, you're vulnerable to being hurt. And when she was saying this, her body language conveyed her beliefs. You know, she sat there in my office, she had her arms crossed, and then she slowly started rocking back and forth, you know, on the chair. And I couldn't help but wonder in that moment, you know, what happened to you that you learned this lesson so early in life? Well, you see, there's even a distinct posture or a body language when it comes to trauma. You know, in severe cases, we may even seen this, or maybe you've even done this, where a person often just curls up in a ball, which is called the fetal position. And that whenever a person receives just overwhelming news or just witnesses a very crushing event, it can cause us to just momentarily just, you know, curl up in a ball or this fetal position, just almost as if to say, I'm going to further protect myself. And this is usually accompanied by a person turning away or even disengaging from those around them. And again, this behavior also appears to be reassuring as well as soothing. And interesting, Navarro states that research has shown that whether you are physically kicked or you are hearing something hurtful, this pain registers in the same area of the brain. And that is the amygdala, which is like the innermost middle part of the brain. And it causes very similar responses. Well, the last example that he gives is often referred to as stiff interlaced fingers. You know, it's just like you just interlace your fingers, but they become very, very tight, very, very stiff. They don't curl around, you know, the knuckles and everything, but they just stay straight out, but they are just interlaced and they are locked in there. And he says that this kind of body language is shown by people who are upset or distraught. Or perhaps it reveals disturbing information about the other person or tragic events or some other kind of difficulty that they experienced. And he says that interlacing, you know, these stiffened fingers, as he says, serves two practical purposes. He says the one, you know, the stiffening of these fingers indicates a conscious awareness or arousal that there are issues, that there is something disturbing. But he also says the second practical purpose is that the interlacing of fingers also causes increased tactile or touch stimulation. And he says, you know, a lot of people just can stay in that position for a long period of time. Okay. But he also says that many people also touch their chest. You know, a person who places two hands over their heart may be doing so to emphasize that they're being sincere in what they're saying. Or if you rub your chest, especially over the heart, that this can be a sign of discomfort, you know, and a discomfort coming from stress or tension. And there are other examples of body language that communicate, you know, things such as feeling ashamed. You know, such as when people would hang their heads or they look away, you know, refusing to make eye contact. Or, you know, we've seen this perhaps in the news that whenever a person acknowledges their guilt or they don't want to be photographed, they often cover their face with their hands or pull a hat down over their face to hide. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, body language and gestures are not just reserved for the world of psychology, okay? Because even within various religions, there are very distinct behaviors that we do to communicate, let's say, our love and devotion. You know, how many of you fold your hands? Well, you take off your hat. If you're wearing a hat, you fold your hands and you bow your head in prayer. Yeah, that's perhaps how many of us were taught. Okay, within the Hindu faith, there are various mudras, or the folding of hands and fingers in a certain way. And within yoga, there are specific postures which convey, you know, our integration of body, mind, and spirit, and just a different, you know, body language that we hold and we breathe through. And in Islam, you know, touching the forehead to the ground is a sign of prayer and devotion. And there's even a Hebrew blessing, you know, that goes something like this, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu, which translated means, praised are you, the Eternal One, our God. And this word, Baruch, or Barak, as it is, just it literally means to bless the Lord. But to take it even further, it means to, you know, drop to your knees or to kneel. Baruch, to bless, hit your knees. Now, I remember back in Sunday school, long time ago, when I was a small lad. In fact, this is actually the only lesson I remembered where they focused on this notion of body language and prayer. I mean, it was just a great illustration. I have never forgotten it after all these years. And, you know, the teacher, you know, settled us down and everything, and she starts in with a question. Actually, several questions. And she says, okay, everybody, can you tell me, does God hear us if we sit to pray? Well, we kind of looked at each other funny, but we all said, well, yeah, of course. Okay, well then, does God hear us if we stand to pray? Okay, yeah, of course God hears us if we stand to pray. Okay, then. Does God hear us if we lay down to pray? Yes. Well, what about if we stand on our heads? Yes. What if we kneel? Of course. What if we're running? Yes. What about taking a bath? Does God hear us if we pray while taking a bath? It's like, kind of silly, but yeah. Of course God hears us. And so the whole point of the lesson was, you know, it's not whether we sit or stand or lay down or kneel, but the fact is that God hears us when we pray. So if we can apply this language of the body when we pray and or worship God, can we also apply the same, you know, body language and posture to God? Does God also kneel? Does God also stand? Does God also sit? Well, of course. Now, if you ever want to do an interesting search, or, you know, Google search or otherwise, just go ahead and Google anthropomorphic language. Anthropomorphic language. It is just a simple definition. We attribute human characteristics and emotions and situations to God. In other words, we just put human language on God. And ancient Israel's faith in God just found very concrete expressions in this anthropomorphic language. And it occurs all throughout the Old Testament and New Testament, okay? There are some places where God is described as having eyes, you know, God is watching. Or God is described as having ears, or God listens and hears the cries. You know, or God, you know, has hands, and God has feet, you know, where God molds humanity out of the dust and plants a garden, and God takes a rest on the Sabbath. And, you know, God certainly speaks, but there's times when God listens. And there's even one interesting place. It's in the book of Isaiah, the 7th chapter, where God even whistles. Okay. And other expressions, you know, give God credit with human emotions, you know, by saying that, yes, God laughs, such as in Psalm 2. You know, and Psalm 2 says, you know, why do the nations conspire and people plot in vain? You know, the kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their chains and throw off their shackles. And the one enthroned in heaven, that is God, laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. So elsewhere, you know, God is, you know, said to rejoice, and God becomes angry. God is disgusted. God's regretful. God's vengeful. And, you know, there's also times when God is described as a jealous God. Well, I really love to hear your thoughts on these matters, your heart on these matters. So I invite you to call in. Let's talk about the posture of God. So again, if you'd like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back, everybody. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Well, just a word about next week's show. You are in for a treat. Friday, April 16th, and then we're going to be halfway through April. But we're going to take a look at the Tao of Pooh, as in P-O-O-H, okay, like Pooh Bear. Okay, the Tao of Pooh. This is a very popular book. I read this decades ago. It's a book by Benjamin Hoff. And, I mean, who doesn't love, you know, Christopher Robin and Pooh Bear and Piglet and Eeyore and, you know, Kanga and Roo and the like, and Rabbit and so forth, okay? Just a beloved, beloved children's stories, okay? But Benjamin Hoff wrote this book where he explains just, you know, what is Pooh? Or as he puts it in terms of Taoism, Pooh. You know, just like Pooh, like you're blowing, you know, a feather. As it's coming down, we just go Pooh, like that. And here, you know, the word Pooh in Chinese means an uncarved block of wood, as he would say. And Hoff goes through and he focuses on all the characters in Winnie the Pooh or Winnie the Pooh, okay, where, you know, this theme of an unworked wood, as you know, he says that the Chinese consider this inherent quality because it's very simple. You know, that was just an early Taoist metaphor just for the natural state of humanity. You know, and think about it. If you're a woodworker, you know, perfect, you will get this, that, you know, how we often take a block of wood or a large piece of wood, we cut it, we carve it, we shape it into a piece of furniture, which becomes very beautiful. But if we take it back into its original state, it is an uncarved block of wood. And all this means is that things in their original simplicity contain their own natural power, power that's easily spoiled and lost when that simplicity is changed. And this principle applies not only to things, but also to people. So tune in next Friday, April 16th, for the Tao of Puh. Okay? Well, earlier in the show, we've been talking about all of our postures and how they convey sort of like a visceral or reaction to something deeper within us. Okay? People bow, we genuflect, we kneel, we fold our hands, and all of these point to something greater from one person to another. And we're not using any words, you know, but it's all through the body language and our posture that is just very, very powerful. You know, it not only communicates a language all its own, but it also conveys our identity. You know, why do we do what we do? I mean, it certainly doesn't explain all there is to us, but it gives other people a glimpse as to what's important to us, or what are we feeling in the moment, or what are we not feeling in the moment? Okay. And, as I mentioned right before the break, various religions, you know, have their own distinct behaviors that communicate a love or devotion or prayer. You know, such as, you know, when we get ready to pray, you take off a hat if you're wearing it, you fold your hands, and you just bow your head, become very quiet. Or you may even pray along with whoever's leading the prayer. And within the Hindu faith, there are various mudras, or the folding of the hands, or just the way that you hold your fingers. And within yoga, you know, definitely the postures and then the body language is conveyed, you know, through one's integration of body, mind, and spirit. And the breath is very much integrated as well. And in Islam, you know, touching the forehead to the ground is a sign of prayer and devotion. And even that Hebrew blessing, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu, you know, praised are you, the Eternal One, our God, literally just means to bless the Lord, or quite even more literally, it means to hit your knees. In other words, to bless the Lord or to bless another person means that you kneel before them. So if we can apply this language of the body whenever we pray or worship God, you know, we can certainly apply the subject of you know, today's subject of body language and posture to God. I mean, by all means, you know, and when we think about the posture of God, you know, how many times we've heard that, like, well, God is sitting on the throne, or God is standing in the midst of God's people. And there's just so much more to the posture of God, because that gives us a little bit of insight, you know, more than this anthropomorphic language of just attributing human factors or human characteristics to God. Because whenever we consider the posture of God, perhaps it's communicating to us or asking us if God behaves in a certain way, if God is displaying a certain body language towards us, what's keeping us from adopting or taking on that body language when we interact with one another? Okay. Well, in her book, The Humility of God, Ilia Delio, and I highly recommend this book. I mean, it's great. It's just filled with page after page of just teachings and insight on the humility of God. And just what does that mean? What does that look like? And she likens it to the posture of God, the body language of God, and just how that brings us into a deeper understanding of not just psychologically or not just emotionally, not just physically, but definitely spiritually in our relationship with God and ourselves and others. So anyway, she writes in her book that, she says, the problem is that while God never fails in bending low in love, and I like that, you know, we serve a God that bends down, that bends low to reach us. She said that the problem is that while God never fails in bending low in love, we, in our, say, fragmented or incomplete natures, often turn away from God. And we often talk about sin and just how that entails a turning from the good and turning towards like a nothingness. Because without God, the self is nothing or no thing. Okay. And she goes on to say that, you know, sin is kind of like, you know, it forces us to be bent over by just the weight, and we're blinded by certain things, or maybe our wills are even distorted and entangled in endless questions. And the person is endlessly asking, you know, just how do I stand up straight? Can I stand up straight when it feels like the weight of the world is just on my shoulders and just weighing me down? So while God is bent down in love for us, we are kind of bent down in love of ourselves. And we're often caught in a web of self-centeredness to the extent that we fail to grasp that the hand of God, you know, or we fail to see the humility of God. You know, we can't fathom that, you know, God would stoop down to our level, not in the sense of, you know, just, you know, not in a derogatory sense. I guess that's what I'm trying to say here. But it's this, that God, you know, reaches out and meets us where we are and loves us where we are. But in that great love, God's not going to leave us in that state. God wants us to, you know, like stand up straight, raise up, okay? And this is all done, you know, for us to know the truth and to know the truth about ourselves and to love one another and be in right relationships with one another and just to act justly and fairly with one another. Okay, she finally just says, like, this is all that what happens when somebody turns away from just all that's bearing down on them, and, you know, and just, you know, turning towards God, and just what a relief it is, and just assurance it is when we realize that God has first reached out to us, even when we couldn't reach out to God. And, you know, she also says that, you know, God bends low so that God can meet us exactly where we are. You know, and we often describe ourselves as, you know, finite or fragile. You know, we're just, you know, we're human beings, but there's so much more to that, but we don't see that. And yet God bends low because, in a sense, we are small in comparison to the world. We don't realize our vastness, so we just think that's all we're ever going to be, or we're just going to say to ourselves, we're limited and or frail or confused, or, you know, sometimes our world gets to be a little chaotic, and sometimes we're just flat out infantile, okay? You know, think about it. Don't we act like little babies at times? We do. We often do. But God bends down to pick us up, you know, in the same way that if you've ever taken care of a baby in a crib, if the baby starts crying or something, you know, it's the adult, it's the caregiver, it's the mom, it's the dad who bends down or bends over into the crib and picks up the baby to feed, to nurture, to soothe. And as the child gets older, you know, the child begins to raise his or her arms up as if to say through their little body language, hold me, pick me up. Okay. And that's a very powerful body language. Parents recognize this at any point. It's just a natural reach. And when a child initiates it, the joy is there. I've seen it many times in people's faces. I felt that when my children reached out. They're like, of course I'm going to pick you up, by all means, because it was just a wonderful way in which we were just able to have that contact with each other, and the love and the care for one another. Okay. Well, yeah, certainly God bends down in love to meet us where we are. Okay? And that is so true. And how many times have we heard, the old saying that actions speak louder than words? Okay? I'm sure we all have. Okay? And this is, this is certainly where we can find just the body language of many people. And just by watching their body language, what they convey is, pain or mistrust or woundedness. A person doesn't need to tell us that they're hurting, but instead we can tell by looking at their eyes or how a person carries themselves, because the weight of the burdens that they carry seem to bear down on them with this immense, immense pressure. Well, I was reminded 1 year when I visited the General Board of Global Ministries in New York City. Just a rather large man was just, teaching us and just sharing, and he gave us a little tour of the Board of Global Ministries, which was huge, and right around the corner from, other large buildings and the UN. But he once told us a story about his missionary work in a local hospital in this tiny African village. And, they were just doing basic medical care for whoever showed up. And, he had been there for months. And it seemed like every week, he noticed a young girl would arrive by herself at the clinic to receive medical care. And when he learned that the girl not only lived in another village miles and miles away, but that she also had the access, she had access to a much closer hospital, that got him curious. And so when she showed up, the next week, he asked her, why she chose to travel so far out of her way. There's obviously hospitals much closer to you. Why are you coming to us? And her response forever changed his life. She pointed to her palms and she said, "The people's hands are different here. They're kinder." You see, how we reach out to others is just as important as to whom we reach out. I mean, how will people know the love of God, the love of Christ, unless we first extend those hands of grace and love? Some people might say that it's a waste of time to reach out to those who don't want help. But I mean, to this, I'll just simply reply. Is it not enough that we reach out in the first place? Because you never know when the grace of God is going to take hold of a person's heart and literally change their soul. And it can just literally change us. Well, one of my favorite passages in the Gospels is when, and you talk about body language here and posture, is when Jesus kneels down to wash his disciples' feet. I mean, it's a very powerful act of hospitality and genuineness and love in that moment. And ironically, one of Jesus' disciples, Peter, of all people, Peter had a problem with this. He's just like, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And of course, Jesus said, "Well, what do you think, Peter?" Paraphrasing, of course. And Peter's like, "Ooh, No, you are not going to wash my feet. I mean, first of all, they're grimy, they're dirty, they probably stink." But imagine the scene here. Here's Jesus, whom Peter, had been seeing all this time, one who heals the sick and performing all kinds of powerful miracles, bending down to wash the dirt and grime from between his toes. I mean, and I imagine in that moment that, Jesus was reminding not only Peter, but all of his disciples that because humanity was bent down by this weight of pain and suffering and sin and misery, this is why he came, and he came to serve. And this is key in reaching out to others and resolving our inner conflicts. We wonder, can we do this? Can we adopt this body language of God and how God kneels down, God bends down to reach us where we are. Can we do the same? Well, it's actually, I wouldn't say it's simple, because it will take us out of our comfort zones, but it can be done, and the transformation is unbelievable. Because in order to do this, we have to first be able to see the divine in another person. And here's a good example of that. If you ever know the story of Francis of Assisi, he grew up in a time, I believe it was the 1200s, I want to say. Maybe it's 1300s. Don't hold me to it, okay? Let's just say the 1200s. Well, he grew up in a time and grew up around the towns where seeing a person with leprosy was very, very common. Okay, but and if you know anything about leprosy, it's a highly contagious disease. And because of this, a person with leprosy was very lonely because nobody wanted to be around such a person. And they were often relegated by society to live in rural areas away from others. It's like, okay, you don't come into town. You just live somewhere else, you know, out of sight, out of mind, almost. And it's told in a story that Francis himself, he just couldn't stomach people who had leprosy. You know, he would avoid them. He would hold his nose if he passed by them. I mean, he just had a general disgust towards people with leprosy. Until one day, he is out riding his horse in a distant field, and he hears a bell. And not just any bell, but a bell that was typically worn around the neck of a person who had leprosy. And the bell was there was to just mainly warn people that, like, hey, you know, don't come near me. You know, one who has leprosy is in your midst, so avoid me. Stay away from me. I'm unclean. Get away. But, you know, this time, instead of turning away, instead of holding his nose, instead of being filled with disgust, Francis was compelled to go towards this person, you know, this person with leprosy. And as the story is told, the person with leprosy just keeps ringing the bell louder and louder. And it's like, dude, don't you hear the bell? Don't you know who I am? But it's also told that Francis was so compelled in that moment, he probably didn't even hear the bell. And he understood that, yes, he was walking towards a person with leprosy. And so when he became very close, or he got close to this person, you know, he was riding his horse, so of course he dismounted, and he walked close to this person, and he looked the person in the eye, and then he hugged the person and kissed him. And in that moment, you know, both men were transformed by an authentic love that values this shared humanity. And Francis was, you know, transformed because he transcended, or he went beyond rather than destroyed the leper label. You know, and this is what the story reminds us, okay? We're not asked to ignore labels and identities, but rather we're asked to look beyond them. You know, are all we focused on are the externals of a person? Are all we focused on is, you know, a disease or a sickness or an illness or a burden that somebody carries or whatever? Or can we see the soul of a person? Can we see them for, you know, something far greater than perhaps what the person sees in themselves? Because Francis acknowledged that men and women were first and foremost children of God. But a distant second, if that, you know, they were then victims of a debilitating disease like this leprosy. And when we think about it, I mean, our identities are complex. You know, there could be thousands of them that we want to take on. And sometimes people label us. You know, and sometimes we label ourselves. You know, sometimes we justify these labels to make ourselves feel more comfortable. And yet, the point is that whatever identities seemingly define us, however inappropriate they are, they never represent the most fundamental truth, which is always much, much more. There's much, much more to us than perhaps we even see in ourselves. But if we can only look beyond these externals, if we can only see people for who they are, that's when we can adopt the posture of God. That's when it finally hits us that God, who loves us better, more than we can even possibly fathom, God who knows everything there is to know about us and yet loves us with such unconditional, intense kind of love, will continue to bend down and reach out to us. Are we willing to kneel? Are we willing to bend down and reach out to others who are just waiting for somebody to reach out to them, to remind them that, yeah, God cares because you care? I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I invite you to tune into next week's show, when we're looking at the Tao of Poo. But in the meantime, everybody, please be safe. Please behave yourselves, and may God continually hold you in the palm of God's hand. Bye-bye.